It's The Wonky Show. There's new research on regret. We'll have a few. The collapse of a private provider. We'll explore what we don't know. And what's going on in WP cold spots. It's all coming up.
You know, the maintenance grant, let's hope it goes up, but it's never going to go up by the gap there is now between what it costs to, you know, to have accommodation and live, you know, even frugally at a university for 3 years. And so something's got to change. It really has.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to explain what's going on behind the HE headlines, as usual, three top-level guests. In the Cotswolds, Mary Kernock-Cook is a serial non-exec director in education and edtech. Mary, your highlight of the week, please.
My magnolia is finally having a baby. I think it's its third season since I planted it. It's always been a really healthy-looking plant, but it's just never produced a single flower. But right now, there's one bud, which I think is actually going to be something more than a glossy green leaf. So that's my highlight of the week.
Well, photo please, and we'll put that in the show notes. In York, Pete Quinn is an inclusion consultant for the sector and beyond. Pete, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, personally, my son got voted most valuable player for his rugby sevens team, and my daughter successfully embarked on our GCSE journey. But the main highlight's been checking in with a few people I've been working with recently, and it's really good to hear the stuff is landing really well, which you don't always know when you go in and deliver something. So that was very pleasing.
Fantastic stuff. And in Chichester this morning, Mac Marshall is Community and Policy Officer at Wonky. Mac, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight this week is that my flatmate Isaac was able to secure us two Lady Gaga tickets for October, which felt like going to war. So very happy about that.
Excellent stuff. So yes, we start this week with regret. Former OFS CEO Nicola Dandridge, now Professor of Policy at the University of Bristol, has launched a thing this week. Mac, what is that thing?
So there's some really interesting research about the benefits of hindsight, which is done through this national study at the University of Bristol. And it's about student satisfaction on their higher education courses. So we're thinking here about kind of the satisfaction with their institution, their choices there, but also the course or program. So this report's been published in partnership with Advance HE and HEPI. It consists of a survey of about 2,000 undergrads, 2,000 graduates, and some follow-up focus groups. Now, the student survey results, about 65% were happy with the choice of what they did and where they studied. 10% would have studied the same course at a different uni. 6% would have studied a different course at the same university. And about everybody else would say they would do like an apprenticeship, defer for a year, go to get a job or something. On the graduate side of things, though, about 48% would do exactly the same. So a reduction there from the current students. And the rest would have chosen differently. Now, the report goes on to recommend kind of two key things to prevent regret when it comes to choice making. The first is about kind of strengthening support when decisions are made as applicants from kind of the core, from kind of the school, university side. And the other is about support for transfer. So not just within courses at institution, but also between institutions.
Well, this is fascinating stuff. Now, Mary, I guess one of the things, because we kind of knew the bit about, you know, the student view on regret, because that's been in the student academic experience survey that HEPI and Advance HE run for 4 or 5 years now. But this thing about regret getting worse later on, that's got to be a worry, hasn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And actually, it's always my most quoted stat from the student academic experience survey, people who regret choices, because I just think it's awful if you go to university and kind of have to stick with it because it's so difficult to get out of it. I was at the launch yesterday in Woburn Towers, and it was really funny because Bristol colleagues scrupulously avoided using the term gap year, and they talked instead about taking a year out. And then Nick Hillman went and blurted out gap year. But I did think, you know, that taking a year out is still a really middle-class concept, not least because it kind of assumes that you're still going to go to university. That's the end goal afterwards. And I think a really important thing coming out of this report is the need to really normalize going to uni at different times, you know, not just a large chunk of the school leaver cohort kind of sleepwalking into uni either straight after school or college or a year later. And there was quite a lot of talk also about lifelong learning entitlement. The report recommends making exit qualifications available at the end of each year. And I think I'd go further than that and make it a condition of SLC funding that there's an exit qualification at the end of level 4, level 5, and obviously level 6. Because I just think it would make it much less costly for students to stop after a year if they had regrets about their choices. And it would create a market for employers looking for level 4 and 5 qualified recruits. And I think it would kickstart LLE flexibilities and just make it just make it an imperative for universities to get behind credit transfer. So, yeah, I think there's some really important ideas coming out of the report. You know, the idea that students have an entitlement to higher education is really powerful, but we need to change the narrative away from the idea that if you don't go straight after school or college, you've kind of missed the boat.
Pete, this thing about when people go that Mary talks about, and this obviously comes through fairly powerfully in the report. One of the stats I often quote to people is that across the OECD, we have the youngest entrance to bachelor degrees. So, you know, they go earlier in the UK than anywhere else. But I am reminded of the moment where there might have been a pause in going to HE during the pandemic. There was like a couple of weeks where people were thinking, blimey, people won't come this year. And the number one thing that providers were talking to me about, you know, quietly was, oh my God, you know, there would be less money. How on earth would the government cover, you know, the students going later? You know, we'd need the money to cover it. And whenever I've written about, you know, more gap years or whatever, people have said similar, that if we were to encourage more school leavers to go later, we would need to find more money to keep providers afloat, wouldn't we?
Possibly. I'm not sure. I'm old enough to remember when, yeah, it was called a gap year without the kind of gap year resonance. And I think it's essential, actually, for many students to take some time between their previous studies and university. In particular, there's a number of students that I've worked with over the years who have a neurodiverse profile and really need to develop some independent skills to be able to then operate effectively in a university environment. It is really unsettling and upsetting that we're still focused on this relentless drive after many years. And I say that having entered the sector professionally in the early noughties in the Department of Continuing Education at Oxford Uni, which saw many people returning to study in little pockets of credit. And we were talking about credit transfer then and adaptability and dynamism, and we still haven't got to that stage, and that's many years later.
Yeah, I was just going to say, one of the things that came up in the seminar yesterday from the focus groups that they did alongside the research was this word railroaded. You know, that students felt they'd been railroaded by their parents and their schools. And so obviously one of the recommendations was about better IAG. But, you know, I think warm words about better advice and guidance, but no parsnips. And, you know, one of the things is for me, it's about empowering potential students to make their choices when they're ready and mature enough to do so. You know, I thought that railroad word that Nicola said, it came up again and again in the research. I thought that was a real kind of wake-up call. And, you know, we need to recognize that parental and school advice is probably too often quite narrow-minded, probably not personalized enough, and probably quite ill-informed as well.
But I mean, Mac, obviously, you know, we've got a blog on the site about it. What Pete and Mary are talking to, I think, is, you know, here's a target reference for folks. The old Ferris Bueller quote, life moves pretty fast. If you don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it. And, you know, the point partly, isn't it, that this isn't just about people pausing before they make their initial HE choice. This is about people being able to, you know, pause throughout the process, isn't it?
Exactly that. I've been thinking a lot in this report about what is the next step? So how do you mitigate for this? Because it seems incredibly hard to, we can't regulate on what parents say to their kids about which institution is better or about what course to do. We can't mitigate for that social expectation stuff or parental pressure. But what you can do is, if they are going to go to uni at 18 and we are going to rush them through in 3 years, we need to make either choice more flexible when it comes to their studies. So give them more options in terms of studying, give them opportunity of interdisciplinary learning, give them options of different module choice so they can explore different niches, so that if maybe geography wasn't their thing, but the sociology of geography or whatever was, and they can explore that and feel less regret as a result. But I mean, and we look at when we went to Poland, we saw like 25-30% of credits for Polish students' courses was optional. It was non-core, and that was a student right. Exactly. And then in Slovakia, there was like, I can't remember if it was a student right or what, but there were so many, it became so common that students would tell us, we can pause our studies, we can take a year out, we can kind of come back to it. It was this ongoing process rather than like a bullet train of 3 years. There's no incentive for universities to do anything about getting their information more clearer. And there's no incentives for schools and colleges to do that either. But the one thing that we can do is make that decision-making more accessible and give more opportunity for setbacks and rests.
Yeah. I mean, Pete, it reminds me of, you remember when, you'll remember this, when there used to only be like four channels and you couldn't change channel on a Saturday night on BBC One without crashing into the middle of a programme on ITV, because the whole thing was about keeping you watching that channel on Saturday night all night. And it strikes me that unless there are really specific interventions, there are just no incentives here for universities to make it more possible to switch, to pause, to gather credit from other institutions and so on.
Yeah, it's become so intense and so focused. It's really unfortunate. I'm just reflecting on it. I was at an event recently where I was doing a particular aspect of the program. And then I sat for the round table after. And there was a huge amount of feedback about new graduates not really being ready for the workplace. And it wasn't the usual, you know, they're entitled kind of commentary. It was more around, they've come from university with a firm belief that they are ready to lead, ready to develop, ready to crush it. And I think that's because they've been given that message, and that's the belief that they hold. They haven't had time to reflect, to develop some skills that are needed beyond the study environment in a workplace, you know, communication, soft skills, those sorts of areas, which in that intense 3 year or 4 year environment without that placement year, and even with that placement year, they're usually done in a very kind of wraparound way. You're usually kind of led through it really carefully rather than dropped in it.
Mary, I think one of the things that you could, you know, reasonably do when reading the report is draw a fairly simple distinction between sort of students who feel they've made the right choice because they're, you know, they're not that interested in the subject or their social environment isn't quite right. And then towards graduation and beyond graduation, the buildup of concern about whether or not they've made the right choice in terms of skills and employability and setting themselves up for the workplace kind of kicks in and becomes much more important. Now, are there ways to kind of enable students to sort of move through that set of concerns flexibly? Or do they have to kind of, do we have to find ways for them to have all of those concerns at 18?
Well, I mean, you've hit the nail on the head, because of course, most school leavers going to uni are actually making choices about their course and their university probably when they're, you know, they're only 17 or something. And they're kind of signing up for a big program, aren't they? 3 years of stuff. And over that period, young people develop so much, both in their interests and their maturity and their kind of sense of self and, you know, who they are and what they might be good at and what they might be interested in. So, you know, I just come back to this idea of making sure there's an exit qualification at each level. I just think that's the way to fix this, so that anybody who does it knows that they've got a stepping off point. And I think it would be difficult for universities to manage, and, you know, it would shake up the sector quite a bit. But I really think it would kind of kickstart the value of level 4 and 5 qualifications. It would kickstart credit transfer. It would kickstart employers beginning to think about recruiting not just, you know, full graduates, but people with level 4 and 5 qualifications. And it would be good for students as well.
Mac, obviously, we hear a lot about, you know, trying to insert employability into the curriculum, right? But, you know, one of the things, I guess, that, you know, we were both talking about the other day when we were writing the blog around it was the, you know, kind of other forms of credit acquisition that are just more explicitly about employability, that kind of takes the pressure off then having to sort of, you know, convert an essay into a podcast.
Yeah, there's so many good examples of kind of placement or internship opportunities that are built into programs. And I think they're fantastic opportunity, obviously, from an employability point of view. Like, students are way more employable by doing a placement, but by integrating it into their studies, you mitigate for the whole time poor students who can't then, they're working two jobs already. They haven't got the opportunity to do that sort of stuff in their extracurriculars, to do that summer internship, which is unpaid and so on. So there's more and more growing examples of that, but it is for 5-10 students on a cohort, not for for everybody. And obviously that's what you're kind of seeing reflected in the graduate results in this survey, is that they are more disappointed that their degree hasn't got them those own employability skills. And it probably links back again to how rushed their programs are, that they're 3 years or kind of shorter. They don't have the time to think about how they can build those graduate skills and those employability kind of qualifications, because they simply just don't have the time.
And actually, Mary, I mean, I don't know whether, I mean, you were at the launch, so I understand some sort of civil servant from DfE was there talking about the LLE. But in one of the places we visited last year, a student was saying to us that they were basically doing 45 credits that year, 45 credits the year before, not 60. And what that was enabling them to do was do a proper, really valuable full-time job alongside just a slightly less intense. So not part-time, not full-time, but kind of three-quarters time. Now, I have no sense of whether or not that's going to be possible or desirable or facilitated via the LLE, do you?
Yeah, no, I think there's still a lot of water to go under the bridge on LLE. And also I just think this idea of full time and part time is just very mangled at the moment, you know, because we're not saying when you do a full time degree, we're not saying that takes up all your time. You know, it's not full time because everybody's doing 20 or 30 or more hours work anyway. But the kind of concept, I think, is that if you're full time, it's all you're doing. You know, that's what all your focus is on your studies for that period of time. And I just think we've got to get away from that. And the LLE should facilitate that. Again, it's going to require universities to get their heads around very different models of delivery and the way they organize their programs and their timetables and so on. But, you know, the old model of going to university for 3 years and doing your studies and having lots of time to do social and sport and fundraising and travel and all the rest of it, I think they're just in the past. They really are. It's just a few from the most affluent families who can still access that, you know, the university experience as we always used to think about it. And I think something's got to change.
I guess, Pete, the other thing that would have to change to make all of that happen is some changes in terms of student finance. Because, you know, if I think about the relationship with Universal Credit or, you know, the circumstances under which someone is labelled as a full-time student and then can therefore access, you know, full-time maintenance, these are legal concepts in the legislation that are donkey's years old.
Absolutely. And you see that across regulations, across different universities about, you know, patterns of study, whether it's full, part-time, etc. When we've been doing research recently about the disabled student experience, the lack of flexibility in being able to return. You know, like you can return to work in a phased return or return to studies after a period of challenge with a fluctuating disability. It's people are aghast at the thought. How can we make that happen? But it's a very standard practice, and that it's just so taught.
Actually, of course, now in the new UKRI contract, in terms of the relationship with PTRs, even much better.
Well, perhaps that was as a result of Disabled Student UK and research that was done by a certain inclusion consultant sitting here talking to you. And it was great to see UKRI saw the potential impact and the particular impact it had on individuals, and it's really significant. So we got to get the framework right so that it's a kind of today experience rather than 5, 10, 15 years ago. And just back to the point about teachers and parents and their influence, they're guided entirely by their idea of university, whether they went or not, where they went. It's still, you know, it's kind of, we're still working on a 15, 20 years ago rather than a now.
Mark, obviously, you know, one of the things that the report tests is whether or not the duty that got written into the Higher Education and Research Act in England, which was to facilitate student transfers, has worked. And, you know, unless I'm missing something, and we, you know, almost every day something appears from OFS that we have to read and write up, that the duty to facilitate transfers has gone very, very quiet, hasn't it?
Well, it's gone quiet because DfE have asked the OFS to stop reporting the amount of student transfers, I think, in 2021. So we no longer have the data on how many students are transferring, which kind of leaves you in a bit of a dark spot. We're going in blind on this. We don't know how many students are transferring. There's no kind of expectation of universities to make make that option available to advertise it. We hear a lot of examples about kind of how students are, if they're thinking about kind of exiting, it's thinking about exiting. It's not thinking about transferring to a different institution. It's kind of an end stop.
But I mean, this, Mary, I guess this speaks to, I mean, you were saying that, you know, some of the recommendations won't butter the parsnips. You know, I do get a sense that one of the things that has to happen to make lots of the stuff that are kind of laudable ambitions in this report work is proper structural work on the kind of scaffolding around all of this, rather than just mild exhortations to kind of do more or say more or you know, push more.
Yeah, I think so. And I think my own view is that quite a lot of the sector has still got its head in the sand. I mean, you can't think of another industry sector, if that's the right word, that, you know, that hasn't had to change its business model over the last, you know, 2 or 3 years, let alone 10 or 20 years. And somehow the higher education sector thinks that it can just go on peddling basically the same product. I know that's a, you know, that's a kind of pejorative term in higher education circles, but I just think if we're going to go on facilitating people to get the advantage of higher education, we're going to have to make it different and make it more accessible. And we're going to have to realize that students are going to need to work alongside their studies. You know, the maintenance grant, let's hope it goes up, but it's never going to go up by the gap there is now between what it costs to, you know, to have accommodation and live, you know, even frugally at a university for 3 years. And so something's got to change. It really has. But yeah, I don't think universities are really on top of all of this.
Fascinating stuff. Plenty more on the site on all of this. For now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Stacey, the COO at the education charity Get Further. This week on Wonky, I've been blogging about how tutoring can transform outcomes for disadvantaged young people and the crucial role universities can play in making it accessible. The attainment gap between disadvantaged students and their peers is at the widest in over a decade. Tutoring is a proven way to boost achievement and help young people to progress to higher level study. But with the government funding ending last year, many schools and colleges are struggling to keep these programs going. This is a particular challenge for colleges where there is no dedicated disadvantaged funding. Without action, tutoring risks remaining a privilege for those who can afford it rather than a lifeline for those who need it most. Universities can play a crucial role in helping to change this by partnering with schools and colleges to embed tutoring within their widening participation scheme. Universities can help drive social mobility, meet their APP priorities, and create valuable job opportunities for their own students. Initiatives like Get Further's College Partnership Scheme show how tutoring roles help students develop key skills while making a real impact in their local community. Investing in tutoring isn't just about closing the attainment gap, although that is very important. It's also about expanding opportunity at every stage of education.
Now, next up, last autumn, a private provider collapsed. And Pete, this week we saw a report on that from OFS.
Yep, so this is about the Advanced Business Academy, which is a provider that had a couple of sites, one in quite close to Canary Wharf, where there's a little cluster of higher education provider kind of satellite sites, which quite a few people know if they've been to that neck of the woods, and one in Luton. The provider was closed down in September 2024, but that followed quite a concerning episode where it was found from an investigation that the Diploma in Education and Teaching, which was one of their major courses that was being delivered, which had a student placement element, they had to have 100 hours of teaching practice. Only 6% of students were fulfilling that placement suitable for the course. Some were taking place in cafes, in freight firms, in even dissolved companies or really small organizations. And this is meant to be your placement as a result, you know, developing your skills in teaching at the FE level. There were also other issues with staff records, suitability for their teaching, governance arrangements. And this was a City and Guilds qualification. So it was, none of the students have been awarded a qualification as a result. So the liquidation took place last September, and only now we're seeing the report coming out. And it does raise a number of questions, particularly if you've got a really poor Ofsted report in a kind of FE level qualification, but you're still delivering higher education qualifications quite happily. Are we okay with that?
Yes. I mean, there are lots of questions around all of this, aren't there? I mean, Mac, you'll have seen the report and the I guess, the thing I wrote yesterday, which was, you know, all the things it doesn't answer. But I mean, one of them is really important. This thing Pete raises, isn't it? Which is, surely, you know, when Ofsted say, blimey, there's a real problem here. One of the questions is, did anything kick in the HE regulator at that point about that provider? Because it's the HE regulator that looks after both the provider and then some of the HE provision.
I think the answer is we don't know. Like, there is an incredible amount of questions which we don't have the answers to when it comes to the closure. We don't know whether, we know that the OFS were considering if this was still operating, doing what, I mean, it sounds like a huge fine. They were even considering deregistering them, but we don't know kind of what steps they were at in their investigation, whether they had already kind of been alerted to the fact that they were going to go insolvent. We don't know whether it was ABA's or OFS's choice to kind of to get them to disappear, basically. The one thing which strikes me in the initial report is that it feels like it's a recommendation for those who are also delivering teaching provision. But that's not what seems to have caused this. It seems to be evidently the fact that it was a franchise for-profit provision, and it explicitly tells us what can and what does go wrong. Now, up until this morning, it wasn't giving us any kind of further regulation on this. It wasn't giving us any more recommendations. It was saying what other teaching providers should be looking at, but not what other franchise provision should be kind of considering in their delivery, and also if they're thinking about closing the course or kind of market exit. Until this morning, when the officer published their insight brief, which feels like a very hasty, stressful document, putting together a load of different kind of, here's things to consider, not here's things that you already regulatory expected to have already done and put in something like a student protection plan.
Yeah, so OFS this morning, about 4 seconds before we started recording, has published an insight brief on lots of things to think about in terms of student protection that does feel like stuff that OFS arguably ought to have put out a couple of years ago, when, you know, everybody was roaming around saying that, at least I was, student protection plans aren't really very good. But I mean, I guess the really interesting thing here, Mary, is it sort of reveals a really interesting gap, which is, to some extent, OFS and lead providers are going to focus on the, you know, level 6 students and the protection arrangements for them. But, you know, if I read everything that's come out this week, it reads like the 2,300 odd students on level 4 and 5 provision have just been completely left high and dry here.
Yeah, I must admit I'm very puzzled by all of this, and looking at it from a sort of governance point of view. You know, in the compulsory education world, it's the responsibility of the awarding body to ensure that the sort of registered centre, which would be ABA in this model, it's their responsibility to make sure that the centre is meeting quality requirements of the course and the qualification. And, you know, for me, the question is, well, what was City and Guilds, and I think Buckingham, and was it Leeds Trinity, who were franchising or validating or something? Why is the spotlight not on them? And then from a governance point of view, how does it work when in this case ABA is itself registered with the OFS? And where does the accountability lie between the awarding body, City and Guilds, and the franchising or validating partners, you know, who are regulated and should be, in my view, overseeing that everything's being done properly at the partner institution? Where does the accountability lie? This for me is a failure of those other organizations as much as ABA itself. And I'm very, very confused about the accountability and where the kind of regulatory lines of accountability lie in this particular case. I don't know if you read from OFS this morning, throws any light on that, Jim?
No, absolutely not. And I guess, Pete, one of the questions, and I think it's a legitimate question, is, you know, one, if we take both the level 4 and 5, you know, the diploma students and the HE students, we, as of today, we still don't really know, one, how many of them were real, and two, how many of them have been successfully placed elsewhere. This is preposterous, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a bit of a confusing picture, because there's about 2,300 students at the college. About 300 of those, it seemed, were on HE courses. These, the just over 2,000 students in scope here from that City and Guilds diploma, were, you know, the ones that had that placement requirement that just clearly wasn't being met and was clearly misunderstood. So, but yeah, it really does kind of strike a chord. Are you happy as Leeds Trinity University of Buckingham, the University of West London were involved, that you're partnering with an organisation that has a really poor Ofsted report from some of their other provision? Now, I've worked with loads of universities, including some of those universities who are franchised, and they're really attuned to Ofsted when it comes to apprenticeships on their campuses and within their kind of purview. So it is a surprise that this happened, but I think it happened quite rapidly in terms of, you know, the closure after the report. But it really does mean that the way that they've done it, we are left in the dark. I was looking around in advance of this, and there's still messages up there on many of the websites about, if you are impacted by ABA's closure, here's who to contact, here's how we can support you. But like you say, there's absolutely no clue as to how many students made use of that. Were they put in successful applications? I think University of Buckingham were mentioned in the OFS report of having reached out to make that offer. But if you're a student on those courses and you're, you know, everything falls apart and the place closes, where are you going to go? Are you going to go up to Buckingham? You know, are you going to go nearby to some of those other cluster providers? How does that work? And why don't we know how many have been helped and supported?
Mary, obviously, you know, to some extent, the story here appears to be, we don't know, but appears to be, SLC is told by DfE to not, you know, pay the third instalment of student loans, you know, to cut off the student loans tap. And then couple of months later, the provider collapses. So, you know, the butterfly flaps its wings and then the provider collapses. And then there are some students who are kind of left high and dry. Now, I guess, given all the stuff that's been going on over the past couple of weeks in the press and so on, if DfE starts to kind of flex its muscles around fraud and so on, and just starts issuing, you know, kind of directions like that, we would need there to be much better protection arrangements in place, wouldn't we, for students caught up in the middle of it? Because, you know, it is at least possible that fairly blunt stuff is done by DfE to avoid lots more difficult Sunday Times from pages.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. And, you know, whatever student protection plan you read, you know that for the students potentially affected, you know, it's never going to be a good outcome, is it? Because, you know, presumably they've chosen a place and a course for all sorts of reasons about where they live and other things. So it's always going to be messy. I suppose in the back of my mind is whether this is actually an extension of the, you know, the Sunday Times type stories recently, and whether the students themselves were genuine. I mean, you know, really, if they were being sent to an employer to do their work experience who didn't have any employees, I mean, you've got to wonder whether the students themselves were kind of genuine in all of this. I mean, it does feel like a scam through and through to me. But as I say, I'm really interested in the kind of governance and accountability implications of all of this and the relationships between the kind of providers further up the chain. I mean, to be fair to sitting guilds, they didn't award any certificates. But yeah, I mean, it's a mess, isn't it? And perhaps the fact that we don't know what happened to the students means that they don't care. They've gone off with, you know, however much of their maintenance loans they could pocket, and they're happy. I don't know.
Pete, let me. I mean, I think there are, in my, you know, reading between the lines in the OIA's blog this week, I think there are probably like three categories of student here. There's, you know, there's students that perhaps, and I don't necessarily mean in this case, I mean generally, there's perhaps students that never existed. There's students who don't really exist. They're just there for the maintenance loan. There's students who themselves have been deceived either by a agent or by a provider. And then there are students who are, you know, just really desperate to kind of get this qualification, might not have been able to get qualifications from other places. And it just strikes me that, of course, it is the case that various people shouldn't award a degree or shouldn't award a qualification or shouldn't make a student loan available via the provider end in order to prevent fraud and the kind of first couple of categories. But there's this chunk of students potentially in each of these examples that keep popping up that are really being properly mugged off. And, you know, even if they've spent all their initial, you know, installment of their maintenance loan on their actual living costs. They're still going to be paying that off for years, and they'll have nothing to show for it in some cases.
Absolutely. And I think it's really regrettable that that's happened. And there is a sense in the reporting around this that there were students who were convinced that they had completed the requirements for their course. And it reminded me of some of those instances in recent years where people doing professional qualifications, it's come to light that their placement wasn't quite right. They didn't do enough hours, or there was a bit of a misunderstanding post-COVID lockdowns. So the regulators there have had to step in and, you know, work with the providers to ensure that enough placement hours were made, and then, you know, they could get their qualifications and go off and work. So even if it is a small number, then it should be the case that there should be some restitution for those students and some compensation so that they're not carrying that financial burden if they you know, studied in good faith. But it's pretty hard to unpick that from the little information that we have and that can be seen in this case, I would say.
And then, Mac, just before we come off this, as you say, this insight brief has come out today. And I guess, at least in theory, if you were reading this, for want of a better phrase, with a straight back, you would read it and think, well, pretty much every student protection plan that currently exists, notwithstanding the fact that in time OFS is thinking about changing that regime, but for now, every student protection plan that exists, if you read that insight brief, needs to be souped up, doesn't it?
Absolutely. There's a whole section in there of kind of things to consider, for things for universities and colleges to consider. And it's like contingency planning. It's how would you teach out a course? How would you give students exit awards? What alternative institutions are around that could offer them those courses? Thinking about kind of the impact on students, particularly it mentions the impact on different groups of students, for example, those that have already impaired employment in those areas, those that have care responsibilities, those that have a health condition or are disabled, thinking about transport, thinking about academic credit, how they communicate with those students. Like, there's a whole load of question marks. But these are all things which surely should already be included in student protection plans. These should be things which universities aren't considering. These are things which should be written down and are way up on ages in advance. And the one thing which does interest me about this in the context of OFS's new fairness condition is that if this new insight brief and kind of the media storm, I guess, around kind of fraudulent use of student loans and franchise provision, if this is a panic response and the OFS are wanting to come down harder, as I say, in their case report yesterday, they said they were thinking about deregistering, that could have been an option. So then why when they're thinking about better regulating on consumer protection, on fairness, and on some of these things around student protection, why is that condition of registration only going to be for new providers?
And finally, a new inquiry from the UPP Foundation is going to look at widening participation in England and make some recommendations about cold spots. What's going on here, Mary?
Yeah, well, I think as usual, Richard Brabner and the UPP Foundation have kind of hit on a key topic in launching this new inquiry into sort of widening participation in higher education. And I think it's true, isn't it, that concerns about university finances and the state of the sector, it's kind of pushed all the conversation and the data about access and participation right down the agenda because the sector's busy obsessing about recruitment numbers more generally and obviously international recruitment particularly. So I think it's very timely to kind of put a spotlight back on this. And they've released this paper today. And right at the beginning, there's this set of kind of summary bolt between the eyes type numbers. And it's a really stark reminder of just how much opportunities for people from more disadvantaged backgrounds are curtailed. Now, they've said they're going to focus on two key themes. So cold spots for higher education, and then also how limited finance sort of impoverishes the student experience because of the long hours worked and no time or money to engage more fully in the traditional student experience, as we were saying earlier. But actually, the one stat from this, and it's really worth just reading these two pages of kind of numbers they've picked out of all the data. The one that struck me most was the number of £859 million spent by the sector on access and participation. And I'm assuming that number comes from published access and participation plans. Now, just imagine for a minute that the government announced today that they were making available £859 million million pounds to reduce inequities in access and participation. I mean, that is a lot of money. And I can only conclude that it's not being spent efficiently as a series of much smaller budgets at individual universities. So I really hope this inquiry won't kind of pull any punches about how to use APP funding more effectively across the sector. You know, I think pooling funds, I think outsourcing to expert charities, and delivering programs of work rather than those that just kind of tick the APP boxes. You know, I really think I'm not sort of criticizing the sector, but I think structurally we've set the sector up to not do well with this 859 million quid. So yeah, it's I think it's a really great topic to bring back into the spotlight. I was also pleased by the way to see an emphasis on boys, who, you know, if we kind of close the gap between not boys, men and women, that would, you know, that would close a lot of the gaps more generally. And also the kind of languishing white ethnic group, which is kind of bottom of the pile for most access and participation data. So yeah, I think it's going to be really, really interesting. And I think it'll be interesting to see how well the sector engages with the inquiry, and indeed what kind of recommendations come out of it.
Pete, the points Mary makes are fascinating, really, aren't they? Because, you know, one of the stats that jumped out to me was 75% of London's teachers expect half their class to go to HE versus only 45% in northern regions. And look, you know, to some extent, we already know that John Blake is going to be encouraging, to some extent, requiring universities to behave collectively, sort of regionally. But what if, you know, for example, right, what if this report comes out and says, well, one of the reasons London's doing really well is there's a lot of universities in London and their WP budgets are being spent on London. You know, I mean, are we really moving towards a position where potentially the kind of slice of tuition fees that students pay that is spent on this stuff might not even be spent in their region, let alone in their university? It might be kind of redistributed somewhere else in the country. Is that a legit use of students' tuition fees?
I would say yes, because I think it's really important that there is I don't want to use levelling up as a term, because of all the kind of political connotations around that. But there's a huge drag on economy with everything being London-centric and London-focused, and it was ever thus. This isn't a new thing. I'm reading this again, and this is, again, I think the APP methodology has been kind of morphed from previous models. And so that 800 million odd will include staff costs. It will include people in posts to do that work. I'd love it to be a bit more dynamic and a bit more focused. So I think it's right that there's a kind of economic and living conditions or you know, living arrangements focus. But we know that there are lots of groups who don't make it. And disabled students, disabled people, people from white working class backgrounds, it's a really important focus to have. So I would like to see a bit of a radical approach to that, to ensure that when we talk about widening participation, we're not just talking about this vague amorphous mass. We're talking about a lot of people who miss out on that opportunity. It's always been the case that teachers have either been barriers or enablers to students going on and considering university. And there's, again, with particular groups who don't make it, oh, university isn't a place for you. That's not a place where someone like you would go, which is not a new thing as well. It's just that I think these are historic problems, and sometimes in some cases wicked problems that have never really been addressed with the urgency and the effort that are required to actually fix and resolve them.
But Mac, let's think this through. You know, on one level, you know, this is really all about where the redistribution happens, right? So on one level, everyone is used to the idea that some tuition fee income doesn't get spent on me, it gets spent on other subjects or other students within a university. John Blake is moving us towards the idea it might be spent on another provider in the region. Is it legit if my course is being cut and, you know, my library opening hours are getting shorter because there's not a lot of money around? Is it legit for a chunk of my, you know, tuition fee that I will be paying off for 30, 40 years to be spent on entirely laudable aims in another part of the country? Isn't that what the general taxation system's for?
You can't help but imagine that students are just going to be I feel a bit mugged off if that's the move more to kind of this individualist approach of, you know, where is my tuition fees been spent? They've increased or they're increasing again next academic year. And if students aren't, at the same time their fees are increasing, but they're seeing courses being cut, they're seeing their module choice reduced, their library hours are being reduced. You can't help but think that they will be frustrated if that money is being spent, you know, over the road at the other university looking at their widening access programs. The one thing I would kind of question about this, or would like to highlight, I suppose, about this inquiry is, if we are going to be looking at regional cold spots and we're going to be looking at kind of student experience disparities, is this inquiry going to look at whether access to participation plans are actually working? Like, do we need another way to intervene, to monitor and evaluate kind of equity programs? Will this regional approach, which John Blake's been mentioning, kind of, will that help facilitate this? But part of me is wondering whether we've just had that kind of that review of the TEF, of Teaching Excellence Framework, a couple of weeks ago, and there's some questions there about how effective it is, but also they reckon that it does drive enhancements in teaching and learning. Do we need the same sort of thing for the APPs right now? Is that the most efficient way to widen participation, or does it need to be done through a different regulatory mechanism?
Well, you know, all really is just, I guess the other thing I was going to ask you, Mary, was that there were some interesting comments in there, I think, about bandwidth. You know, it's not just about money, it's partly about bandwidth inside providers. You need more bandwidth if you're collaborating with other providers, and bandwidth in the regulator and in central government too. In this world we're in, you know, we wake up this morning to find out what Trump's done on tariffs and, you know, mass economic chaos and so on. In this world we're in, we are really short of bandwidth for solving these wicked problems, aren't we?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, but I'm going to segue onto another important point. You know, when I first got involved in UCAS in 2010, you know, there was still a narrative in the university sector that schools needed to do better in order to improve access and participation. And then the pendulum swung the other way, and all the responsibility was put on the university sector. And I think it would be really helpful if this report did kind of reach into, you know, secondary education, because, you know, there's an awful lot of school sixth forms, which is where A-levels are generally done, which are suboptimal in size. And this is particularly the case in the cold spots. You can't get good teachers to go and teach, you know, in kind of coastal and rural areas. School sixth forms are shrinking. Schools can't afford to run optimal sixth forms. So kids there don't have the choice of A-level subjects and BTECs and so on that they need. Very often the college is, you know, is far away and they can't afford the travel costs and so on. So I think there's kind of some structural stuff in the secondary education system that has got to be part of this story, because, you know, universities can only do so much, but, you know, schools also need to have the resources and the structure and the access to teachers and so on to be able to get people to qualify to level three in order to progress to higher education. So I think it would be helpful if there was a bit of a balance in the narrative coming out of this inquiry about, you know, some of this is what goes on in schools. You know, I still think that the biggest barrier to participation in higher education is about GCSEs, not about sixth forms. You know, if you don't get a good handful of GCSEs, you don't go on to level three, and then you're going to have a real problem progressing to higher education. So there's a whole lot of stuff in there that actually reflects on how well resourced and structured schools are, and then indeed, you know, whether there's enough access to colleges and sixth form colleges in areas, you know, a lot of schools don't even have a sixth form. So, you know, they don't really have any accountability for whether their pupils go on to higher education. So, you know, this is a bit more complicated than how well universities, you know, kind of do their outreach and their aspiration raising and, you know, information giving and open days and all the rest of it.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything going on in UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Mary, Pete, Mac, Michael, Salmon, who makes the show happen. We'll be back next week. Mark will be here. Until then, stay wonky.